A terrorist is sentenced. A surge in Brazil's evangelicals. The Democratic Party considers inhaling, and going green just might mean going noisy. It's Thursday, September 7, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Tuesday's sentencing of Faisal Shahzad in a Manhattan courtroom brings to an end one of the most important terror trials in recent American history. Mr. Shahzad, you might remember, is the 30-year-old young man who drove an SUV filled with explosives into Times Square in a premeditated attempt to try to destroy and kill as many people as possible. In the course of the trial, in which he had pled guilty, Mr. Shahzad indicated that he had planned another attack within 2 weeks if he remained at large after the first attack. Thankfully, the first attack was defused before it detonated. Mr. Shahzad was quickly apprehended, and his plot began to unfold and unravel. The life sentence that he received on Tuesday allows no chance for parole, and it was a sentence that he negotiated due to the evidence against him and the likelihood of further charges and penalties. In his closing statement to the court, Mr. Shahzad said, "Brace yourselves, because the war with Muslims has just begun." He continued, "Consider me the first droplet of blood that will follow." Clearly, the young man had aged greatly in recent months, and even as Judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum had set down his life sentence without a chance of parole, Mr. Faisal Shahzad was just as belligerent as ever. The oaths and threats that he uttered were offered as direct rationalizations for his attempted terror attack. As the New York Times reported, Mr. Shahzad said, "This is but one life. If I am given 1,000 lives, I will sacrifice them all for the sake of Allah, fighting this cause, defending our lands, making the word of Allah supreme over any religion or system." All this comes, of course, as several European governments had issued very direct alerts, given the threat of a major terrorist attack somewhere ill-defined in Europe over some time, also ill-defined over the next several weeks. Security experts on both sides of the Atlantic suggest that these threats are credible, and there is some conjecture that government authorities had such direct warnings that they dared not delay in hopes of continuing their investigation. Instead, they have offered a general alert that many governments, if not most in Europe, seem to be taking seriously. Faisal Shahzad's sentencing on Tuesday is a reminder to all of us of what is at stake, and it is also a signal of things to come. We cannot say that we were not warned. Over the last several years, there has been a great deal of discussion about the shift in the center of gravity of world Christianity. For centuries, it had been in the northern continents, but now there's a shift to what is being called the global south. Evidence of this came in the Wall Street Journal this week, as news reports indicated that in Brazil, a surge of the evangelical population is now catching the attention of the nation's major political parties. Pablo Prada, reporting from Sao Paulo, indicates that the number of evangelicals in Brazil is literally surging. The country of 190 million people may now have, it is estimated, as many as 30 million evangelical Christians. Just 20 years ago, that was only 10 million. That is a threefold increase in just 20 years. Continuing his story, I quote, "What is more, as Brazilians left the Catholic Church for other denominations in recent decades, the demographic makeup of evangelical churches has broadened, now including parts of the middle and upper classes, in addition to the original blue-collar base." Now, this Wall Street Journal news story goes on to suggest that Brazil's political parties are having to take these evangelicals into account. In terms of issues, the issue of abortion is front and center, as several of the parties seeking evangelical support are now considering whether they should attenuate, modify, or even reverse their historic stances on the legalization of abortion. This story from the Wall Street Journal is an indication of how powerful the evangelical influence is in Brazil, but in a more general sense, it is a pointer to the Global South and its influence. The Global South includes nations in the continents of Africa, Central and South America, and of course a good deal of Asia as well. The Global South is the center of world Christianity now, already in terms of population. Just as one example, there are many more Anglicans worshiping in sub-Saharan Africa than in the nation of England and Great Britain, where it was born. The shift to the Global South is bringing theological changes. The nations of the Global South, in terms of their Christian populations, tend to be much more conservative than those found in the North, especially in Europe. They're also much more inclined towards Pentecostalism and charismatic expression. The shift toward the global South is, on many issues, a shift in a more conservative direction. At the same time, it's also a shift in terms of language, culture, and ethnicity. Make no mistake, this is going to mean a major change in the tenor and texture of world Christianity. When the Wall Street Journal takes note of a resurging population of evangelicals in Brazil, and when Brazil's political parties begin to enter the evangelicals into their political calculations of the future, something clearly is going on. We'll be watching this as well as the political scientists. Political parties exist in order to seize political advantage. That's why citizens organize into parties, and that's why, over time, major parties gather so much influence, momentum, and power of persuasion. One interesting news story in the Wall Street Journal indicates that the Democratic Party is, well, it's considering something a bit unusual in terms of an effort to mobilize young voters. Peter Walston, reporting in Wednesday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, indicates that Democrats are looking to marijuana, private pot, as an issue for the 2012 elections. Now, why? Well, as Mr. Walston indicates, right now in California, the Proposition 19 issue appears to be drawing an unprecedented number of younger voters. This means voters under the age of 30. The tie between the younger voters and their inclination to go to the polling place and the issue of marijuana on the ballot has not been missed by many. Several Democratic pollsters and strategists are suggesting that the legal pot issue, for instance, in the states of Nevada and Colorado, if on the ballots in 2012, might have an effect similar to what many conjecture was the effect of the same-sex marriage constitutional amendment in states such as Ohio in the 2004 presidential election that pitted incumbent President George W. Bush against Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. Now, there is a good deal of speculation and debate going back to 2004 as to whether or not the same-sex marriage amendments did indeed provide the decisive factor of turnout that gave the election to President Bush. But nonetheless, the Democrats are looking at the issue of legalized marijuana in terms of a specific portion of private possession legalized, and they're seeing this as an issue that just might bring out youthful voters that had been mobilized in the 2008 general election as major supporters for President Barack Obama, but may have become disillusioned or politically inactive and need something of a jumpstart in order to remobilize them for the 2012 election. Those who are responsible for the re-election of President Barack Obama, and at this point that means a constellation of Democratic Party strategists, pollsters, and persons inside and outside the White House, they're watching this kind of development. It might be seen most classically as a cynical ploy of a political party to use whatever issue might be to its advantage. But we're supposed to be the people as Christians who know that we are living in a Genesis 3 world. And sinners, both individually and collectively, will do what seems to be their best advantage. Now, as we look to this particular news story, there's more here than meets the eye. This is not only about marijuana. The legalization of some quantity of marijuana as a political factor in California, potentially in Nevada and Colorado, in this election cycle, but potentially also in 2012, this is also an indication of just how powerful the marijuana lobby and the marijuana issue has become in modern America. Now, the evidence of the Democratic Party's interest in the issue is interesting enough. And by the way, that news story again was in Wednesday's edition of the Wall Street Journal. But in the New York Times, just a couple of days earlier, there's another report indicating that the publishing industry has also found great interest in the resurgence of sales of marijuana, and in particular, in the legalization of medical marijuana, primarily in the populous state of California. Now, the publishers we're talking about here are specifically newspaper publishers, and the subset of newspapers we're talking about here are primarily those alternative papers, these that are found in most metropolitan areas and best exhibited by the Village Voice in New York City and its allied newspapers across the country. The headline in the New York Times story is this: New Fuel for Local Papers, Ads for Medical Marijuana. Now, this is no small matter. As this news article indicates, several of these papers are now burgeoning with these ads, growing thick with paper as page after page of medical marijuana advertisements are made as each of these suppliers seeks to ply his wares. Now, what's really fascinating in all this, of course, is the fact that medical marijuana is something of a ruse in the first place. Almost no one believes that only those who have a genuine medical need for the marijuana are receiving it. Instead, what's particularly interesting in these advertisements is that what is often not advertised is marijuana. What is advertised is a medical consultation that allows the patient then to go on and buy a certain amount of marijuana for so-called medical use. The issue of marijuana is not going to go away anytime soon. It goes back all the way to the 1960s and has been a perpetual issue over the last five decades. One of the things that we must keep in mind is that the hippies and the children of the 60s who first popularized marijuana in terms of the broader American culture, well, they are now reaching retirement age. They are, interestingly enough, still pushing as a generation for the legalization of marijuana. A great percentage of the aging baby boomers are still pressing for this, but now they are followed by Generation X, the millennials, and other young adults who are now reaching voting age. It will be interesting to see how the marijuana issue unfolds, but in some states, it will not even be presented in terms of the medical marijuana argument, but just that a small possession of marijuana should not be a legally significant issue. Will the issue of legalizing pot mobilize younger voters to the Democratic Party? That remains to be seen. But is this an interesting story? Well, that's already evident. One of the most significant industrial issues over the last decade is the rise of green industries, and in particular, efforts to provide green power, green energy, and just about any good or service that will serve the ecological cause. Insofar as business and industry can find a commercial application, a market, and a strategy for delivering services, you can count on investors and industrial and business energy going into the opportunity. Wind farms have been erupting across America as calls for passive and green energy have led to the interest of wind turbines and the energy that can be ecologically produced by means of these giant blades twirling, often in deserts, often off the coasts of both the Atlantic and the Pacific, and now often in controversy as well. According to the New York Times, there are now about 250 wind farms in North America, and about a dozen of these have become very controversial because of the issue of noise. Even though these wind farms are the very essence of green in terms of using passive energy, transforming it into marketable energy, what we have here is a reminder that there are complications with any technology. One thing is clear. These wind turbines, even though they seem silent from afar, at close distance, well, they're anything but silent. Citizens around many of these 250 farms, and about a dozen of them in particular, indicate that the noise is oppressive, bothersome, and some are claiming even dangerous. Now, the issue of wind farms has become controversial, even among some who have claimed to be defenders of the ecological cause and agents of the green movement. Some political leaders, like the late Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy, are all for passive energy, but not when it's in their own backyard. Now these wind farms are becoming issues of litigation. A judge recently decided not to throw out the case of the challenge against one in particular that is seen to be holding the power to become a precedent for how other of these wind farms may be adjudicated in terms of noise and other claims as well. The most responsible scientists looking at the issue of climate change are now suggesting that what is most needed are market-friendly solutions. In a democratic system of government, that is a necessity. Citizens will have to judge that the trade-offs are in their advantage, and that means the long-term advantage of the earth and the ecosystem as well. Now, this New York Times article, well, it tells us that even a wind farm, as seemingly passive as it is not politically passive. The noise is not irrelevant to those who are hearing it, and at least in the ears and eyes of some, the existence of these wind farms and other forms of passive energy may be worse than the less passive forms of energy they are hoped to supplant. No one knows exactly how this case is going to turn out, but the reality is that if we are to have a sizable addition of passive energy to this nation's energy grid, it will not mean 250 wind farms across North America, but thousands. Clearly, these issues are going to have to be resolved. Now, on the issue of green and noise, there's another story that's even more interesting. The Wall Street Journal reports that the Frito-Lay Corporation, a subsidiary of PepsiCo, is going to pull its Sun Chips and the biodegradable bags of several of the Sun Chip lines because customers have complained that the eco-friendly biodegradable bags are just too noisy. They're too noisy in the house. They're too noisy at a picnic. They're just too noisy. Now, any seller of goods or services has to be aware of backwash from consumers. The consumer can say, I simply will not buy this product, and there's the reason. It's too noisy, it's too big, it's too cumbersome, it's not of sufficient quality, it's too expensive. Well, if you're a retailer, you have to take all of this into account. But one of the new factors is noise. Is it not fascinating that consumers put back so much pressure upon PepsiCo and Frito-Lay that the company finally surrendered and said, all right, if the bags are too noisy, we will replace them. And they're going back to the old bags that are not biodegradable and are less eco-friendly. Now, even as Frito-Lay says, it's going to maintain the biodegradable bag for at least one major line of Sun Chips. The reality is that this is a surrender of what had been claimed as a corporate advance and a contribution to turning green. Now, as we look to these issues, well, let's just remind ourselves that what we have here is a series of trade-offs. Biodegradable bags or noise? These issues are surely indicative of the kinds of quandaries, questions, and trade-offs we're likely to face in the future. Regardless of your perspective on the issue of global climate change, this much is now clear. If customers will not put up with biodegradable packaging simply because they claim it makes too much noise, it appears that the American people are not yet convinced that this is a major crisis or issue. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. You'll find a wealth of resources at my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I want you to know about the upcoming W Conference to be held on November 19th and 20th of 2010. This is a conference for women known as Women of the Word. For more information, go to sbts.edu. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.